So this, normally I script everything I say in advance, but I'm not doing that right now because before I start today's interview, I just want to momentarily lose it with you guys about what just happened. I'm recording this at 4:01 p.m. August 8th, which is yesterday by the time this airs. And I just conducted an interview with a man named Luke Yankee, who's the son of a woman who knew Marilyn Monroe. I thought it would be endearing and we would get to know Marilyn Monroe more and it would give us this insight into her life, but I didn't think it would be substantial in a criminal way. I thought it was going to be more just personal and experiential and expository, and so I'm a little bit blown away by what was revealed at two points in this interview. Luke Yankee reveals two things, and I need to do some digging, and I need to figure out what his sources are, because he reveals two things about the final days of Marilyn Monroe's life that are blowing my mind. And there are things that I've read, but I'd written them off as pure conjecture, and now it seems as though there may be more credence to them than I'd known, and maybe I shouldn't be so excited before I talk to him again and figure out his sources and then do some more research. But honestly, even though this death is so suspicious, it's so suspicious, Marilyn Monroe's death, I had come to an inner conclusion that she died of an accidental overdose. And now, after today's interview, and I don't know if I'm just, if I'm just caught up in excitement and in the fresh aftermath of these revelations, and I'll feel differently tomorrow or not, but I honestly, right now, I feel like it was murder. So, I'm about to probably lose my shit a little bit and do a lot of research and start posting a lot of stuff. And let's figure this out. Ava Michael's story closely mirrors that of Marilyn Monroe's. And I think it's really important. And also, I'll add that the jury hasn't delivered a verdict yet in real life. But now I want to go to the source of this entire narrative, which is the real story of Marilyn Monroe, and I want to figure out what happened there. So, okay. I'm going to pour myself a drink. I'm going to edit this interview. I'm going to post this. And that's going to be my night. I love you guys. Thank you for listening. Please enjoy the interview. Today we're speaking to director, author, playwright, Luke Yankee, son of Eileen Heckart and author of Just Outside the Spotlight, receiving an inside glimpse into the real life of Marilyn Monroe.
My mother was the actress Eileen Heckart, who won an Academy Award for the film Butterflies Are Free and is in the Theater Hall of Fame and, was nominated for several Emmy, well, I believe 8 Emmys, which she won 2. 3 honorary doctorates. I mean, she had a career that's lasted more than 50 years, and she pretty much never stopped working during that time. But as you say, Chelsea, she was certainly not a household name. I mean, she was always kind of known for playing the best friend or the next door neighbor, that sort of thing. And she was where she was kind of considered royalty to an extent was on Broadway, really in the 60s, 70s, and beyond. I mean, she enjoyed doing film and television, but she really loved the theater, and that was where her heart was. And of course, was very proud to be part of films like Bus Stop that she did with Marilyn. In the film of Bus Stop, which many people consider Marilyn's best film, Mom played a role that was actually created for her in the film. It was the role of Marilyn's best friend. And in the play version of Bus Stop, it all takes place in the one locale, sort of in the truck stop diner. But the film obviously opens it up a great deal. And at the beginning, when Marilyn is singing in the saloon for pretty much the whole first half of the film, my mother played her best friend, who was the waitress in the saloon. And because Marilyn was such a method actress, she really befriended my mother. And because this character was, you know, they were supposed to be best friends, Marilyn made a point that they became as such. My mother had two sets of stories she would tell about Marilyn. One was about this woman who was very unprofessional, coming to the set late, not knowing her lines, and someone who was really indulged in the worst sense of the word by the whole Hollywood star system. And the other set of stories, to the day my mother died, she could never tell without bursting into tears. And that was about this woman who was terribly vulnerable, desperate to be loved, desperate to have a child, and someone who was constantly looking over her shoulder for the next starlet who was going to come along and dethrone her. And, you know, isn't it ironic that all these years later, no one really has? And so, you know, it was really so amazing to watch, I mean, you know, 30 years after this had occurred, for my mother to still burst into tears when she talked about Marilyn. And I think the film, My Week with Marilyn, really captured that in so many ways, so many brilliant ways, because on the one hand, you would see how people were so exasperated by her. And on the other, you could see this woman that they absolutely adored and wanted to take care of because she was so vulnerable and so fragile. And my mother definitely saw both sides of that and would talk about both sides of that on you know, regularly. Some of the stories that my mother used to talk about in terms of Marilyn, one of my favorite ones was my older brothers. I wasn't born yet, but because this was 1953. Might have been a little later than that, but it was in the early 50s. And no, I'm sorry, it would have been about 55 or 56. So, pardon me, my brothers were little boys and they were shooting out on location in Phoenix. And Marilyn had the top floor suite at the hotel and my mother had the suite one floor below. And Marilyn just was so desperate to have a child and had had such a terrible childhood herself. She really latched on to my brothers, who were, I believe, 2 and 4 at the time. And one of their nightly rituals is that these studio types were constantly sending Marilyn these gift baskets and, you know, trying to gain favor with someone who was really probably the biggest star in the world at that time, certainly one of them. And Marilyn would go into these gift baskets and she would take out the grapefruits and oranges and she would go out onto the balcony and call to my brothers on the balcony below. And she'd say, "Mark, Philip, you want to play a game?" And the two little boys would come running out and she'd say, "You want to play catch?" And Marilyn Monroe would play catch with my brothers on the balcony below, down these grapefruits and oranges. And of course, at ages 2 and 4, they weren't very good catchers. I don't think they ever caught one. So my mother would be in the other room on the phone with my father back in Connecticut. And she'd say, "Oh, for God's sake, Marilyn's out there playing catch with the boys again. And guess who's going to have a raggedy ass down at the pool at 2 a.m. picking up all the damn grapefruits and oranges?" She was really incredibly dear with my brothers, and we've got some wonderful family photographs of Marilyn on the set, you know, holding my baby brother Philip, and I'm the youngest, but you know, he was a baby at the time, and my other brother Mark, she's got her arm around him. And one of the other stories I remember Marilyn, my mother telling about Marilyn, which is really the other side of the spectrum, was that she spoke in the Okie accent, the sort of hillbilly accent she used in the film the entire time. Again, that was because she was such a method actress, and maybe she was afraid she was going to lose it, or it was just about staying in character, I don't know. But there was an assistant director on the film, and this is someone who had crossed her when she was a bit player. So he came to the trailer and introduced himself on the first day of shooting. And there she is.
When you say a bit player, you're talking about someone considered unimportant.
Exactly. When Marilyn was on her way up and when she was playing small roles.
Right.
Exactly. So this assistant director comes to the trailer and introduces himself. And she says in her thick, oaky accent, she says, "Oh, I remember, darling, when I was a bit player, you were just as nasty as a little old snake to me. Well, darling, things have changed now. And every time you come to my trailer to give me my call to be on the set, you're going to have to stand on your tippy toes." And he just sort of laughed and walked away.
Right.
And came back about an hour later. Exactly. He came back about an hour later and knocked on the trailer door. And again, she's sitting there practically stark naked. She used to say, "I'm not wearing anything but the radio." Or I don't have anything on but the radio. That was it. So he says, "Place it, Miss Monroe." And she just keeps very slowly putting on her lipstick. And she says, "On your tippy toes, darling, or I'm not moving." And so he stands on his tiptoes, and through clenched teeth, he says, "Places, Miss Monroe." Well, now that's better, sugar. And she made him do that for the entire shoot of the film. He had crossed her when she was young, and boy, she did not forget that. She could be terribly vindictive, and she certainly was with this man.
Wow. So she had a pair on her.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the other story that my mother used to tell about her, and I share all these stories and the photographs in my memoir, Just Outside the Spotlight. And this is a story about one day when they were shooting in the stands at the rodeo. And Marilyn really started letting her hair down to my mother. And as I said, really befriending her. And she started talking about the many foster families she was bounced around to as a little girl. And she talked about this one foster family. And my mother saw her eyes starting to well up as she told this story. And she said, "You know, there was this one family, and I really think they wanted to keep me. But they were already in their early 60s, and they felt they were too old to have a small child. But when they sent me back to that orphanage, they gave me a little straw hat with a matching straw suitcase. And, you know, that was the finest gift I was ever given in my entire life, because I really think that old couple might have loved me."
Oh, God.
And my mother would just bawl like a baby every time. She couldn't get through that story without breaking down.
I can understand why. That is so heart-wrenching.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, again, just another example of this woman who was so desperate to be loved. And what you were saying about Arthur Miller, I think he was such a father figure to her. My mother worked with Arthur Miller on A View from the Bridge, one of his early and very big hits. And pardon me. And, you know, she talked about what a kind, gentle, loving man he was. And so it just totally makes sense that he would be a father figure to Marilyn.
Oh, that's so interesting. It's fascinating to me that she had opportunity to work with the both of them. And they've become this sort of historically important couple, at least one that, you know, continues to retain our cultural fascination. But thinking of him as a father figure, it makes sense because I have always thought that she desperately sought to attain his approval, as she wanted to be considered an intellectual, and he was the epitome of the intellectual. And
absolutely.
And she,
absolutely.
And his approval, it seems that she was constantly seeking. And you mentioned a movie earlier, My Week with Marilyn. And if I'm not mistaken, that movie is the one starring Michelle Williams, where it talks about the when she was playing the lead in The Prince and the Showgirl with Laurence Olivier, is that correct?
Exactly. And it's the thing that put Eddie Redmayne on the map as well. He was brilliant in that film, as was Michelle Williams.
It was a great movie. I saw it myself, and I completely agree with you. And I bring that up because I've heard an anecdote, possibly through that film or through reading, in which it was during that time, it was a very stressful time for her marriage with Arthur Miller, which was new. And she found some writings by him or a journal entry or something of that nature in which he put her intelligence down or in some way diminished her intellectually. And that was a huge blow to her. And there was this big emotional reaction. Do you know the experience?
I don't know any of the particulars about that, Chelsea, but I do remember that scene in the film, and it certainly wouldn't surprise me. I mean, my mother used to talk, too, about the way she would, I mean, again, you know, with these just, not that we don't all have many, many facets, but there was this woman who was just so smart about her career and so knew the camera. And pardon me. Then there was this other woman who was just so incredibly vulnerable. But my mother said she would watch her go through a stack of photographs, you know, proofs on a contact sheet with a grease, marking them up with a grease pencil. And she could go through like 1,000 photographs in about 2 minutes because she knew her image so well. And my mother had never seen anybody go through photographs that quickly. Said it was just so amazing how she did it.
Wow.
I
don't want to interrupt you, but I just want to say it's amazing to hear you say that because I've heard of her doing that. I've read in books about her taking markers or a grease pencil and like marking up these photos. And so to hear that your mother actually had that personal experience with her is pretty amazing to me.
No, she was so amazed at how quickly she could do it. The other thing that my mother said about her, and this was really an incredibly terrifying moment. They're in the stands shooting at the rodeo. Out on location in Phoenix, as I mentioned. And at the end of the day, they were walking back to their trailer and, you know, there was no security around. And my mother was a little surprised that there wasn't. I mean, you know, this was long before people had bodyguards or anything like that. But you would have thought there would have been someone to escort Marilyn Monroe back to her trailer because, you know, since they're in the stands at the rodeo, there's a huge crowd around.
Right.
And so the two of them are walking back. And one person says, hey, I didn't get a picture with you. So she stops for a moment, Marilyn, and poses for the picture. And then somebody else is like, hey, wait, you gave her an autograph, but you didn't give me one. And this, she watched the crowd start to get more and more hostile. And Marilyn just leaned into my mother and said, whatever you do, just stay by my side. And so Marilyn just starts walking faster and faster and signing autographs and posing for pictures and just walking faster and faster as the crowd is almost like descending upon them and getting tighter and tighter and more hostile and more belligerent. And my mother was like, how she could walk that fast in 3-inch heels was beyond her. But so finally, the last, say, 50 yards or so to the trailer, Marilyn just broke out in this run and Mom was right by her side because the crowd was just getting, you know, so belligerent. And they got into the trailer and locked the door and people were pounding on the door to the point where my mother thought they were going to overturn the Winnebago. She said if she had never watched somebody work a crowd like that, and she had never seen a mob turn like that. She said it was one of the most terrifying experiences of her life.
Oh,
I mean,
my
she
God.
Really thought that she and Marilyn were going to be mauled or seriously hurt or something. It was, you know, like those things you would see about the Beatles or something like that. I mean, it was just really a very disturbing experience for my mother.
Of course. I mean, how terrifying. And obviously that kind of experience is something that Marilyn Monroe was used to. Like she,
exactly.
From the way she handled herself, that was something she had been through before. So I can only imagine how many times she'd been descended upon by an overeager crowd.
Exactly. I mean, it just my mother said, as you said, from the way she handled it, she knew it was sort of not an uncommon experience for her. But my mother was both in awe and frightened for her life at the same time.
Right, of course. And I will just say to my listeners very quickly, if you Google rodeo bus stop, or perhaps it's bus stop rodeo, the second video down, at least as of today, as of the day that we're recording, August 8th, you will see a very short clip of Marilyn and Luke's mother, Eileen, the person whom we're talking about today.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's funny. I heard a story, another kind of silly story about Marilyn when she started dating Joe DiMaggio. And she said something like something to him early on, like, well, you know, you don't really know what it's like to go out in the middle of a crowd and have, you know, thousands of people screaming your name and worshiping you.
Wait, she said that to him?
Yes, she did. And he said, oh, she totally got who he was. And she's like, actually, I do know what that's like. Which is one of the reasons I think they were such a good match.
I know. The relationship between them is very sweet. I mean, there are rumors that he was physically abusive during that marriage. I don't know if they're true or not. Obviously, if they are, you know, that would change my opinion about things. But I also know that they maintained a friendship until her dying day. And he was always there for her, even past their marriage. He would visit her often. And after she died, he's the one who arranged her funeral. And he arranged for a bouquet to be delivered to her gravesite every day.
Breaking off the interview momentarily to note that I fact-checked this and I was wrong. It was not every day. It was twice a week. So I just wanted to call that out. Thanks. Back to the interview.
Yes. And as a matter of fact, I've heard on very good authority that at the time of her death, they were planning on reconciling. They were planning on remarrying.
You've heard that on good authority? I've heard that rumor.
Yes.
Really?
Yes. I actually heard that from someone who was a manager to Frank Sinatra at the time, who traveled in those circles, obviously. And at the time of her death, they were going to get together, back together.
Wow. I mean, you have no idea how big of a deal it is for me to hear you say that you've heard that on good authority. I've read that in books, and I've contemplated so many like versions of the final days of her life, and that's one that I actually disregarded. So to hear that that might have more credence than I gave it is hugely interesting to me. Wow. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's just so amazing to me, Chelsea, that all these years later, I mean, she has remained such a cultural icon. And I think, you know, she certainly would have felt the same way about it. I'm just totally shocked about that. It's astounding.
It's true. You know, you say that your mother describes her as someone who was always looking over her shoulder for the next star that was going to sort of usurp her. And that was ironic because no one ever did. I don't know if that would have been different had she survived or not, but I do know that it's certainly true. You know, there are all these rumors about her rivalry with Elizabeth Taylor during the time of her life. And at the age, she was 36 at the time she died, which is very young. But at that time in Hollywood, it was not considered as young as it is today.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so I can understand there was that sort of, impending paranoia descending upon her. But she has remained a legacy and will always remain a legacy. I mean, there's something magnetic about her. There is something deeply intriguing about her, her life, her words, her performances. If I'm looking at a photo or if I'm looking at a video of Marilyn Monroe, I can't look away.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, when I talk about my book, Just Outside the Spotlight, and I just sort of flippantly say, yes, I talk about Ethel Merman teaching me how to make a martini at age 10, and Marilyn Monroe babysitting my brothers, and Paul Newman giving me acting lessons in the living room. People are like, wait, what? For real? What?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
People just always kind of shocked about that. But as you said at the beginning of the interview, I mean, since my mother played the second banana to kind of all of those people over the years, it's, I grew up in this rarefied atmosphere that was, you know, not unlike Auntie Mame with all these really flamboyant characters coming around. And I would just sit at my mother's feet and listen to these amazing stories from her and from people like Teresa Wright, who was a dear friend, and Mary Tyler Moore, and of course, the Newmans. I mean, Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward met doing Picnic on Broadway, which was my mother's first Broadway show. And Paul Newman was playing the small supporting role of the rich boy next door because the producers didn't think he was sexy enough to play the leading man. I have a feeling they kind of ate those words in times to come. But
I'm sure they did.
Indeed. So, yeah, it's really been kind of an amazing life, and I'm so thrilled that I got to chronicle it in just at my book, Just Outside the Spotlight, and in my one-man show, Diva Dish.
Yes, yes. I'm so glad you mentioned Just Outside the Spotlight, because it's an amazing piece about your personal experience, your mother's personal experience, knowing all of these stars and having this really unique glimpse into old Hollywood, which is something I've always been fascinated with. So that's a book available for purchase if anyone wants to find it, Just Outside the Spotlight.
And I'm really thrilled that it just came out in paperback. And Mary Tyler Moore wrote the foreword to it before she passed, to the original book, God Bless Her. And
Eileen, sorry to interrupt, but Eileen, she knew Mary Tyler Moore because she was on the Mary Tyler Moore show initially?
Yes, she played Mary's Aunt Flo in the old Mary Tyler Moore show. And they became great friends. Really great friends.
Mary Tyler Moore is an incredible person, and your mother was amazing on that show, and she also played that role on the spinoff, Lou Grant, right?
She did play that role on Lou Grant, and also Mary had a TV series after that. She tried to recreate the energy several times in the Mary Tyler Moore show, and one of them was a series called Annie McGuire, where my mother played her mother. So, again, you know, they remained very close, and Mary was very gracious and generous when I asked her to write the foreword to the book.
Oh, how lovely.
Yes, yes, just such a lovely person. And they were very close for probably the last 15 or so years of my mother's life, maybe more than that, actually. But and I remember spending some time hanging out on the set. And Mary was always, you know, knowing that I was in the business, Mary was always trying to make introductions. And this is somebody you should meet. And I mean, she just could not have been more lovely and gracious.
That it makes me feel so good always when I hear that people I really love and respect as performers are people that I love and respect in real life.
Absolutely. And another thing about Just Outside the Spotlight that I'm really incredibly proud of, I don't know if you're familiar with Michael Musto, who was the critic for years on The Village Voice in New York and a very, very respected arts critic, and now has a major online presence at several different publications. And he named Just Outside the Spotlight one of the 10 best showbiz memoirs of all time. And yes, really. And it's gotten several other accolades like that and tremendous reviews across the country. And I'm just really, really proud of it. And the other thing about it, Chelsea, if I may say, is that, yes, it tells a lot of stories about old Hollywood and the golden age of Broadway. But at the heart and soul of it, it is not only a son's loving tribute to his mother, but a story of an incredibly complex mother-son relationship that is ultimately very loving. And it's totally has its foundations right there.
It absolutely does. I'm a sucker for a complex relationship. And for anyone who isn't familiar with Eileen Heckart, just Google her and look at her. And I really think that you'll recognize who it is we're talking about, because she is so ubiquitous. If you're at all interested in old Hollywood, she's been around a lot. And so it's been a real privilege to talk to you today, Luke. And I didn't mean to cut you off before you had an opportunity to mention Diva Dish also.
Thank you so much. Just briefly, after my mother passed away and my two older brothers and I were going through the house and sorting through this all of this memorabilia from a 50-year career, for instance, one of my brothers would come across a photograph and he'd say, "Hey, Luke, what's this picture?" And I'd say, "Oh, that was from the time Mom was hanging out on the set with Clark Gable." "Well, when was Mom ever on a set with Clark Gable?" "Oh, you know, that great story she used to tell about when she was doing that film with Mervyn LeRoy, and he knew that she was such a fan of Gable's, and so she invited, Mervyn invited Gable to come by the set, and Mom just sat there drooling the entire time." And he was like, "Well, no, I don't remember that story." So I realized that I was the keeper of the flame, and I was the only one who knew all of these stories. I was the one who had paid attention, and if I didn't do something with them, they would be lost forever. So I sort of, you know, pieced together what I knew myself and certainly what I remembered, and interviewed a number of her friends and colleagues and spoke to people like Teresa Wright and Ed Asner, who's somebody she worked with several times, and you know, just compiled all of these stories into Just Outside the Spotlight. And also into, but before I wrote Just Outside the Spotlight was the precursor, which was my one-man show called Diva Dish, where I showed all these film clips and clips of her winning the Academy Award and a lot of her film clips, of course, a clip with Marilyn in Bus Stop. And really just kind of, it's as if I'm sitting in the living room listening to all of these stories, and I sort of take on the persona of all of these people, whether it was Bette Davis shredding her on over, you know, contrasting political beliefs, or Marlene Dietrich telling her how awful her makeup looked, or, you know, like I said, the Newman, Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, and just all these amazing stories about the golden age of Broadway and Hollywood. And then I would have a list of about 25 names in the program, and I would bring up the house lights at the end of the show, and I would say to the audience, shout out a name and I'll give you the dish. So thus the title, thus the title Diva Dish.
I love that.
And somebody said to me, Luke, this has got to be a book. Where's the book? So the very first publisher I approached at Backstage Books in New York jumped at it, and then subsequently was picked up by Random House. And as I said, it's just out in paperback, and you know, thrilled that that her old cocktail party stories have given me so much pleasure over the years, and have given it to so many other people.
Right, and have now made history.
Indeed.
Well, I love the fact that you shared all of these personal stories about Marilyn Monroe with us, and I hope that it's not distasteful. But before I let you go, I feel compelled to ask you, do you have theory as to how she died?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah. Let me just say that when I heard that she was going to get back together with Joe DiMaggio, she had announced a press conference for the following week to give that piece of information.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Wait, the press conference was real?
Yes. She was going to give, she had arranged a press conference for the following week to say, I'm getting back together with Joe DiMaggio. She didn't tell anybody what the press conference was about. And I will simply say other people thought it was about other things.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I'm freaking out. Like, this comes up in my season. Like, I've scripted a storyline about this press conference. This press conference has been like mythologized over the course of decades. And I mean, okay. All right. Sorry. All right. Your theory. I'm not trying to interject. I'm not trying to interject.
No,
I'm just not so silently freaking out right now.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, like I said, I heard from, an acquaintance who was a manager of Sinatra's, that the press conference that she had scheduled was not what other people might have thought or assumed, but it was to announce that she was getting back together with Joe DiMaggio.
Oh my God. I mean,
so it makes things all the more tragic that it was misconstrued as perhaps being a press conference about, shall we say, something else?
Yes, we shall. Oh my God. Honestly, I mean,
I'll let you and your listeners fill in the blanks.
Okay, we'll do that. Thank you. I can't believe that. I'm freaking out. I mean, because that's one of the stories that is the most easily shrug offable. That's not a term, but you know what I mean? Like, I read a book recently about her final days. That was very thorough, and it talked to it spoke to a televised segment wherein she was recorded as announcing this press conference, but kind of offhandedly and drunkenly, and by a reporter, and it was never actually aired. And then but a few people saw this recording. Yeah, sure they did. Like, there are so many theories out there about the final days of her life that the idea that she was hosting this press conference is something that I've heard mentioned time and time and time again, and something that I just grew to believe was probably total conjecture.
That's not what I've heard. Obviously I can't say for sure, but that's not what I've heard.
Wow. Well, all right. That's an excellent note to end this on, because I need to go think for a while and drink for a while. Oh, wow. Okay. Wow. Well, I'm really glad I asked you that question then.
Yes, indeed.
So, one more time, Anyone interested in hearing these stories more in depth and learning more about Luke and his mother and their relationship and her stories from old Hollywood, please check out Just Outside the Spotlight. If you have an opportunity to check out his one-man show, Diva Dish, absolutely do that. I've seen clips of it online. It's phenomenal. And Luke, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today. I've enjoyed it more than you know.
My great pleasure, Chelsea. And I just want to add that I have a website, which is lukeyankee.com. And I also have a YouTube channel where I have clips from Diva Dish and stories of my mom talking about Marilyn and the story about Ethel Merman teaching me how to make a martini and Marlena Dietrich and a whole lot of fun stuff.
Thanks for listening. I'm going to do some Googling and I'll be online between now and next week. Check out the Facebook group Deliberations Room if you want to talk about it. And you can also find me on Twitter @DeliberationPod. Thanks a lot, guys.